here on BBC Radio 4, where now Simon Evans goes to market. This week, Simon asks why we buy and sell gold around the world.
To Simon Evans Goes to Market. This series is all about the grown-up stuff in the newspaper that comes between you zoning out during the letters page and coming to again as you enter the world of sport. The business news, the half-dozen pages in the middle of every newspaper whose headlines seem to be written in morphine. Sleep, they seem to say. Sleep. It's like the core of the news apple. You know it's important, but it doesn't taste nice and it ends up in the bin, even though it's actually the one bit that something useful might come out of, like another apple. Well, wake up. And before you start spinning the dial looking for something less taxing, it's quite simple. Don't you want to be rich? Of course you do. Don't you at least want to be able to dismiss wealth as a possible route to happiness from first-hand experience? And even if money is, as many people in business say, really just a way of keeping score, doesn't that sound like the kind of healthy, irreverent disregard for the stuff that you would quite like to cultivate, rather than thinking, yes, get in, every time you find an unexpected fiver that has survived a wash in the coin pocket of your smart jeans? There is only one way for most of us to get rich, and it isn't through hard work, marrying well, or releasing your own fragrance. I released my own fragrance earlier today and all it earned for me were a few dirty looks from my fellow passengers. The secret is through piggybacking on other people's hard work. This is known as investing, and it is an important life skill. And it's not just about greed. Becoming economically literate is a great way to understand the world and the forces that really shape it. Otherwise, you end up thinking that your present difficulties are a sign that God is angry, like a medieval farmer or an American. If you want to know whether they're likely to, for instance, build a third runway in the Thames estuary, you could listen to Boris Johnson yakking on about it, but you'll learn a lot more from taking a quick look at what's happening to shares in BAA, Essex land prices, and futures in massive Toblerone bars. Of course, it cannot be overstated just how ill-equipped I am personally to discuss any of this. Beyond a certain way of speaking, at any rate. I do have two of the country's foremost economists to help me, however. The presenter of Radio 4's More or Less, Financial Times columnist, Tim Harford. Tim, for someone who clearly does understand all this stuff, quick question. Why aren't you rich?
I should be richer, shouldn't I? I think the main place I went wrong is not writing Freakonomics. That would really have helped.
Have you actually ever wondered whether you would be better off just, like, sitting in front of a screen all day trading furiously?
Well, I once interviewed the economics and business writer Michael Lewis. He wrote Moneyball, you know, very, very, very successful economics writer. And I said, well, I guess it works out for you. He sold millions of books. And he shook his head. He said, oh, no. I would have been far, far richer being a mediocre investment banker than the most successful economics writer in the world. So you've got to pick your right profession.
Thank you, Tim. And tonight, a woman whose name certainly makes her sound rich, editor-in-chief of Money Week, Merin Somerset Webb, is on the line from Edinburgh. Merin, why are people resistant to the idea of investing?
Yes, everything about money is actually remarkably simple, but we have come to believe that it's very, very difficult and therefore it's expensive and that we can't anticipate what the result will be. Now, if a financial advisor came along to you and said, you know what, investing is really incredibly easy, you can do it by yourself in 10 minutes, you don't need me, it wouldn't really do them any good.
So in other words, people aren't investing because they're intimidated by deliberately malevolent investment professionals. Let's see if we can put that right. This week, we're going to look at perhaps the most iconic but arguably most ridiculous embodiment of wealth still in play. Yes, gold. Of all the materials currently traded on the world's markets, this bright, chemically inert metal is paradoxically perhaps the darkest, the most corrupting, the most mysterious. Cherished by mankind since the dawn of history, beloved of inbred Egyptian despots, English pirates, and Swiss bankers with a dubious notion of neutrality. Gold has always dominated our febrile delusions of grandeur and led us astray more often than an Amstrad own brand sat-nav. The power of gold has transcended the ages, as has nothing else. Gold is special. Don't take my word for it. Here again is Merrin.
Gold is special.
See? When pressed to say why, I'm not sure even Merrin can quite put her finger on it.
Look around at everything else. Is there anything else that people can trade easily between themselves that's rare, that has a finite supply, that is almost impossible to destroy? You know, you can recover gold from any accident, any time. It doesn't go away. And that you can make into anything, and that you can make into small, valuable blocks and store, but also into tiny little bits that you can sew into the hem of your skirt. There isn't anything else that is quite like gold.
Tim, why has this basically useless, if delightfully shiny metal become so highly valued by humans? Why is gold special?
Well, there are lots of things that would make good money. So back in the day, people would use salt to denominate contract. If you were going to borrow money or you were going to pay a salary, you could pay it in salt.
Table salt.
Which is why we get the word salary. It's based on the Roman word for salt. And that's because salt was very, very stable in value. You only needed a bit of it, had a stable way of producing it, so that's a good thing for money. But salt doesn't make a very good coin. You start to go through the elements, and you think about the alternatives to gold. So hydrogen blows up. Helium floats away. Sodium is very
reactive.
Also,
helium makes you speak funny, which would probably ruin the contract you were about to seal with the...
So sodium keeps turning into other stuff. Lead's too common. Mercury's too runny and it's poisonous. Uranium gives you cancer. Even iron will rust. You've only got a few very precious metals. Platinum's too rare. You'd have tiny, tiny, tiny coins. So you've only got gold and silver left. That's one of the reasons why gold has started to absorb our attention.
All right, historically, I can see that, but that's in an era before ultraviolet pens and banknotes and those three little numbers on the back of your credit card that so entirely wipe out the opportunity for fraud. What... Why, 4,000 years on from that era, does gold still hold such a tight grip on our imagination and of the world's banks and governments and, you know, serious players?
Well, I'd be tempted to say that gold's in a bubble. It's just been a bubble that's lasted, you know, maybe 5,000 or 6,000 years. That people are still interested in gold because they know that other people are interested in gold. I mean, that is the fundamental thing. I mean, sure, there are some industrial uses. You can use it for jewellery. There's a lot of demand in India because it's a portable way of carrying around wealth as jewellery. But mostly, the reason people want gold is because they believe that other people will also want gold. And that's just a dynamic that's continued for thousands of years.
It's something of an enigma, isn't it? Let's see if we can break it down. Gold is now worth $1,350 an ounce, give or take, which is not quite as expensive as it sounds, since gold is measured in troy ounces. A troy ounce is an ancient measure originally used to weigh wooden horses to see if they were suspiciously heavy. And troy ounces are nearly 10% heavier than the other kind and significantly shinier too. But even so, $1,350 an ounce, it's a lot. To give you some idea of how much, let's say, madam, may I ask you, how much do you weigh? No idea? No? OK, listen. I'll take a guess. Let's say you're about 10 stone. I'm being generous. I mean, in terms of... I'm being generous, as in I'm giving you a lot of stones. I'm not being generous emotionally. I'm being harsh emotionally. I'm being generous, like a generous portion of something. So, has anyone ever told you that you are worth your weight in gold? They have. Excellent. Well done. What were you doing at the time? OK, keep it to yourself. It's fine. He's sitting right there, for God's sake. So... did you wonder how much that might be? No, it wouldn't occur to you. But let me tell you, if you were, let's say you are 10 stone, that's just an average weight for a female adult in this country. I wish. But, but you're around that. That would work out at about 2,100 troy ounces, which would put you on the London exchanges at £1.7 million. It's quite a healthy amount, isn't it? To work out whether you genuinely are worth your weight in gold, we would have to know how old you were and how much time you had left, as, you know, as a professor. I'm not going to go, because you've already given yourself up to an extraordinary degree. Fact is, you're probably, to be honest, you're depreciating at a fast rate now. This is not... it's not personal. This is just what happens to humans, which is why gold, you know, is a more valuable commodity than most of us are. But there it is. So that's... That's given us some idea. A 10-stone person, male or female, would be worth about £1.7 million. Despite what Tim has said earlier, I'm still not convinced that it has any unique qualities which make it uniquely appropriate for coinage and currency. Why not, for instance, say diamonds? Merrin?
Diamonds are absolutely useless. Apart from anything else, they're not in short supply. This is a great myth invented by De Beers. Well done, De Beers. But there are diamonds all over the place. Diamonds also come in different grades. There's crap diamonds and there's good diamonds. Gold, there's only one gold. It's always the same. So if you had diamonds, you'd be constantly saying, well, that's a rubbish diamond. That diamond is only worth half of my diamond because I've got a good diamond.
I think it tells us more about Merrin than it does about diamonds. That she thinks they're everywhere. Clear these bloody diamonds up, will you? Tim, Merrin says gold is rare. Do we have... Is there a measure? Is there a scale on which rarity can be defined?
We have an idea about how much there is in the world. There are different estimates, and they do disagree, but if you put it on centre court at Wimbledon, it would be just short of 10 metres high. So actually, not that much. We think of all the gold in the world, but we don't really know. There could be loads in some supervillain's bank vaults.
And has anyone ever worked out what kind of a playing surface that would offer? Who would that favour?
Rafa Nadal,
I reckon. Yeah. Let's discuss the fundamentals about gold and see if we can find some kind of quality in the stuff that explains its huge value. Right back to basics, it's known to crossword enthusiasts by its chemical symbol, AU, which I've always thought is kind of appropriate, as in, AU. It does seem to beckon to us, doesn't it? AU, come over here, I show you good time. No. Chemically, gold is an unusually inert metal and, like Homer Simpson, is dense, yellow and surprisingly soft. And also occasionally radioactive. Gold is mined on every continent on Earth except Antarctica, and that's only due to meddling environmentalists. They can only keep us away for so long. This is probably a reflection of the fact that almost all of the gold ever found arrived here in a meteor shower some 3.8 billion years ago. That's right, gold is genuinely otherworldly. It all comes from outer space. And that's also, incidentally, why it's mostly quite near the surface, in Earth terms, generally speaking. The single largest nugget ever found was in Australia, just 2 inches below the surface dirt. It was over 2 feet long and yielded 2,248 ounces of pure gold. That nugget, incidentally, was named the Welcome Stranger Nugget by its uncharacteristically poetic Australian prospector. Presumably Big Yeller was already taken. And equally, during the great California gold rush of the mid-19th century, tons of the stuff literally was found lying around in the dirt and blocking up the rivers. This gold rush, incidentally, pretty much populated the west of America and introduced the whole new 2.0 version of America itself. Whereas previously the American dream had been about the traditional Walton's family values of patience and humility, suddenly it became all about guns, loud trousers and massive lumps of money growing out of the California soil. Thanks, gold. Having said that, most countries do have their destiny determined at some stage by their access to particular mineral deposits. That's just a reality. We in this country, I think, in the United Kingdom, have always been rather sniffy about countries that get their wealth through mineral deposits. We like to think we're more of a skills-based economy. Our primary skill, of course, traditionally having been that of persuading other countries to give us their mineral deposits. So, worth bearing in mind. Tim. Gold has been found in every part of the world and by every civilization, but they haven't all treated it with equal reverence, have they?
Well, some of the South American and Central American civilizations before the conquistadors arrived, there's a lot of gold, and they weren't using it in the way that the Spanish felt it should be used. They were sort of sprinkling it around, and the Incas didn't really have money at all. They just had a system where you did what you were told rather than because somebody paid you to do it. And the Mayans apparently used feathers of a bird called the resplendent Quetzal.
The resplendent Quetzal?
Yeah.
I've never heard, is it like a parrot or something?
I think it's resplendent.
Rather resplendent, yeah.
The clue's in the name.
And they used its feathers as money.
Yeah, and they used the gold
just to scribble all over the walls.
John Maynard Keynes had this essay where he pointed out that the money that Francis Drake had taken from the Spaniards, given to Queen Elizabeth, she had invested that, compound interest. It was an important part of kick-starting the British Empire and making Britain what it is today. He actually forecast what size the economy would be round about now, how rich we would be, very accurately. What he didn't understand is that rather than sort of knocking off work on a Tuesday lunchtime, we'd actually keep working and spending all the money on, you know, buying houses and so on, rather than just relaxing, sitting around, you know, having sex with strangers and reading poetry. As Keynes and his friends like
the life
to
of
do.
An economist. Yeah. Yeah. So our good fortune by world standards over the last few hundred years was largely down to the gold that Drake robbed from the thieving Spaniards back in 1560 or whatever.
You That's know, the theory.
And that kick-started the whole thing. To help us unpick that story, I'm joined by the author of economics bestseller Life After the State. He writes on commodities for Money Week magazine, Dominic Frisby. Dominic, thanks very much
for coming along.
Now, gold, you're saying, it's not currently as politically sensitive as it once was, but it wasn't that long ago that the countries pegged their currency to something called the gold standard.
Well, the way that the gold standard worked, in simple terms, is that the central bank would take people's gold and they would issue notes in exchange for this gold, and that note said, I promise to pay the bearer X amount, and people stopped using gold coins in the marketplace, and they started using these notes in the marketplace instead. So paper money, representative money, was replacing commodity money, effectively. And gradually, over time, central banks decided to regulate this practice. They took a monopoly of it, if you like, and the central bank was only, or the Bank of England, for example, could only issue as much paper as it had gold in the vaults.
Right. No leverage at all.
Well, they found ways round it. During the Napoleonic Wars, they needed to print money to pay for it. We come to 1914, the outbreak of World War I. Germany, France and Britain, we all took our countries off the gold standard to print the money that we needed to pay for that war. And it was only by coming off the gold standard that the war was able to go on for as long as it did.
Wow.
In 1971, America had a very expensive war in Vietnam that it needed to pay for, and it had printed way more dollars than it had gold to back them. And France, Charles de Gaulle, started saying, actually, you can have your dollars, we'll take the gold. There was a run on American gold, and as a result, in 1971... America came off the gold standard.
And at that point, I know that, a gold shot up in value almost immediately.
It did. Well, over the next 10 years, it went from $35 an ounce to $850.
Whereas the dollar sort of slunk off into a bathroom.
The money that had been printed and created through the 1960s, the effects of all that came in the 1970s through the huge inflation that we had.
So now, on a personal note, Dominic, you got involved in this, didn't you? You'd started to take an interest. It was about, 2005?
2005, 2006. I knew nothing. I became very interested in economics and finance, and it became very clear to me that the world, that we had way too much leverage, there was too much debt, we were about to, and it was all going to unravel, and we were going to go to hell in a handbasket. And it still amazes me, no economist of any note saw it coming. No broadcast, no journalist, no economist. There was this huge bubble. And so I sold my overpriced terraced house in London and I got rid of my mortgage. The word for a mortgage is actually death grip, is the root of that word. And I rolled the money into gold.
And did people say to you, you're mad?
Everyone thought I was absolutely insane. But the plan was to sell the terraced house, buy gold, when it all went tits up, sell the gold and buy a palace. That was the that was the rough plan. The way it panned out is that I was doing very well by about 2011. That terraced house had become maybe a detached house. But unfortunately, since 2011, the housing market's rocketed and the gold market's done that. So I'm back at terraced house, unfortunately.
But you haven't been ruined, at least.
I haven't been ruined, and I'm hoping for a loft conversion soon.
Now, when you did that in 2005, did you find yourself falling into step? Did you find you had a lot of very queer bedfellows? Because there are a number of people who, you know, gold bugs, they call them, who believe that gold is at the root of a conspiracy of worldwide banking and politics and so on.
Well, gold, even now, it's still a really political metal. And, for example, the USA, it's only foreign exchange, it doesn't have any foreign exchange except gold. And its gold hasn't been audited in 50 years. And
I'm
so
sure
people go...
Sorry? I'm sure it's still there.
Well, that's the big... Well, of course, I'm sure it's still there, but the joke is the head of security goes to President Obama and he says, Mr. Obama, there's no gold in Fort Knox. And Obama says, what do you mean there's no gold in Fort Knox? And he said, well, there's no gold in Fort Knox. And Obama says, double the guard. But, I mean, I'm almost sure it's all there, but until they audit it, we don't know that it's all there, and it has to be audited independently. And when you don't know a truth, conspiracy theories develop.
And meanwhile, the last great folly involving gold was probably that of Gordon Brown, who was wandering through the Exchequer one day and stubbed his toe on a big lump of the stuff and decided to flog it all out of spite.
Well,
this was in, I think, about
1999 it was, and it didn't mark just the low in the gold price, it marked the low in gold relative to housing, relative to stocks, relative to the bond market, relative to just about anything you can think
of. He literally couldn't have chosen
the
worst time.
The all-time low, not just of our lifetime, in history. I mean, it was the most phenomenally bad trade that has ever been made.
And just finally, before I let you sit down, you've been fantastically interesting, Dominic. Just one last thing. You're now writing a book, I believe, about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. And some people have said this is, in a sense, is the new gold, because it is another thing into which we simply we invest its wealth, its value, without it having any intrinsic value. We believe it does. And so is it working in a similar way, or are there...
Well, there seems to be a 100-year cycle in money. 1716, the first recoinage, 1816, 1914, and the monetary system that we currently operate under is screwed. There is too much debt, it is corrupt, terrible things have happened. It's also not that technologically advanced. It is controlled by banks and governments. They have a virtual duopoly. And Bitcoin, or let's expand it out and say new forms of digital cash, offer a new technology by which people can make and receive payments that doesn't involve banks. And I personally believe that if not Bitcoin, maybe Bitcoin has to fail so that others can succeed, but it is going to lead to the future of money lies in some kind of manifestation of digital cash.
Fantastic. Very, very interesting. Ladies and gentlemen, Dominic Frisby, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Tim, have you learned something?
I've learned a lot. I've learned that gold protects us from governments wantonly printing money, except every time they actually want to. Napoleonic
Wars,
first of all, whenever they want to, they'll do it anyway. So.
But it gives them a brief pause, and I suppose it at least alerts us to the fact that they're up to something at that point. As an economist, do economists find gold fascinating, or do they regard it as a slightly sterile subject now?
I think economists find it. Fascinating in the sort of we don't really understand what all the fuss is about sort of way. I mean, there must be something in it. If economists all think it's nonsense, there's probably something in it.
Would you buy any?
No. I mean, for me, gold, it's a bit like Wile E. Coyote in the Roadrunner cartoons, you know, just not yet realising that gravity applies. The strangest money, perhaps, in human history comes from the island of Yap in the South Pacific. And Victorian anthropologists who arrived on the island of Yap found that up to 10% of the male population of Yap were taking rafts over to Palau and mining this money and bringing it back to Yap. And the money was a kind of stone donut. Sometimes it was quite small, you know, about the size of an actual donut. But some of these donuts were absolutely colossal. They'd be a couple of yards across, they'd weigh as much as a small car. And those were the really valuable coins. Now, the curious thing was about this money is it was obviously rather inconvenient to move it. So I might want to buy a pig from Simon, and we'd agree the transaction, but we wouldn't actually move the coin, because it was too much of a faff. Everyone would just know, well, that donut out the back of Tim's house, well, that's now Simon's donut. And so these transactions would take place in this entirely mental space. Everybody would just know who owned which donut, and the donuts would never, ever move. There was even a case where one of these rafts coming back from Palau sank half a mile off the coast of Yap, and everyone agreed, well, we knew whose donut that was, and it's perfectly good money. It's just down there at the bottom of the sea. So, very, very curious system. You think, well, this makes no sense whatsoever. And then you think about our own monetary system. It used to be that we would have gold and we'd pay each other in gold. But that was inconvenient and very insecure, so we put the gold in bank vaults. And if we wanted to pay somebody, you could go to the vault, but it might be easier just to write a little note that says that you own the gold and pass that note to somebody else. So now you're passing this paper money around. The gold, just like the stone money, is staying exactly where you put it. And all you're doing is passing the bits of paper around that says, well, that used to be Tim's gold, now it's Simon's gold. So I'm not sure that the stone money of Yap is quite as weird as we think. We've now taken the ultimate step. We don't bother with the gold anymore. We just pass the paper money around and it doesn't refer to anything at all.
Still, it clearly is regarded as a safe haven at the very least, and not just by wild-eyed survivalists and conspiracy theorists. Merrin Somerset Webb, who is on the line from Edinburgh, holds down a very steady job, and yet she says gold is still important.
Well, this is the very interesting thing. You know, if you ask most economists, they'll tell you that gold does nothing, that it's meaningless, that it's all over. The gold standard was years ago and no one's interested in gold anymore. But then you see that every single central bank around the world holds huge amounts of gold on their balance sheet. And if it isn't important at all, what do they want this stuff for? And the reason everybody wants it is that it hedges their dollar exposure. So if you've got lots of dollars, when the dollar price falls, the gold price rises. So it hedges that. But also it is still, even today, recognized as the only real long-term store of value that we have. There isn't anything else that is recognized all over the world by every culture, by every economy, as having an intrinsic value of some kind.
Well, there it is. Gold remains an enigma, but perhaps that is its strength. The bottom line is that gold still draws on a significant consensus that it offers a hedge to the short-termist political machinations of Westminster buffoons, not to mention their US counterparts, and there can be few people who don't acknowledge at least some virtue in that. If you want to take our experts' median view, let gold account for between 5 and 10% of your portfolio, but try not to stay up too late on the internet reading about why it may or may not be running the entire world. And if you want my view, don't buy shares in a fund, don't buy bullion, and certainly don't buy shares in a mining company. Get yourself some ducats, some sovereigns, some Krugerrands, some pieces of eight, some big, exciting, lumpy nuggets, and maybe a nice little chest to keep them in, perhaps a map too, and a few yards of oilcloth. And yes, why the hell not a parrot? In fact, a resplendent Quetzal. Who knows? It could be the start of a great adventure. Thank you very much. I've been Simon Evans. Take care. Good night. You have been listening to Simon Evans Goes to Market with me, Simon Evans, Tim Harford, Merrin Somerset Webb and Dominic Frisbee. It was written by Simon Evans with Benjamin Partridge, Guy Venables and Andy Walton. And the producer is Talusha Galani.
And Simon returns next week with a show all about oil.